Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. And now, here are Bob and Richard.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. I'm Bob Dancer.
And I'm Richard Munchkin.
Our guest today is Dr. Alan Schoonmaker, a psychologist who has written extensively on the psychology of poker. Dr. Schoonmaker, welcome to Gambling with an Edge.
Glad to be here.
How accomplished of a psychologist are you, and how accomplished of a poker player are you?
As a poker player, I'm no great shakes. I play almost exclusively limit poker, and I play, generally speaking, small stakes. I do it for two reasons. One, I'm very comfortable there. And two, there's a lot more variance in poker players at small levels. The higher you go, the more similar people become.
And how accomplished of a psychologist are you?
Well, I can honestly say I have published more about the psychology of poker than any psychologist in the world.
So you have 32 books, is that correct?
I have 32 books, but that's... That includes about 16 translations and a whole bunch of books on other subjects like selling and negotiating and college life and career strategy. I've written 8 books about poker, and they've been translated into, 7, 8 languages. And I've published maybe 220 articles on poker psychology for Card Player, for Poker Digest. Couple other places.
Right. I've been reading you in Card Player and things for...
Yeah, forever.
Forever, yeah.
Do you still write for them?
Oh, gosh, yes.
Oh, gosh, yes.
In fact, I just submitted one this morning.
Uh-huh. All right. So, you have a website.
Yes.
That is a mouthful.
Well, when you got a name like Schoonmaker, everything's a mouthful.
It is. So it's DR as in doctor, hyphen, AL as in Alan, hyphen, Schoonmaker, Schoonmaker .net.
Yep, that's it.
All right.
And we'll put a link to the site in our show notes.
Thank you.
All right, so one of the things that is really noticeable on the website is you're coming out with a second edition of a book on negotiating called Negotiate to Win, Gaining the Psychological Edge. And if our listeners go to your website and fill in a form with their name and email address, you will send them a free Kindle copy of that book, so long as they do it before when?
Well, if you guys are in the publishing business, you know that everything is late, all right? And I had expected the book to be out by now. It's hung up in editing. You always find something wrong. And so I'm hoping to get it out in early May, but you know better than guarantee anything in the publishing game.
So when it actually is physically published, then the free offer is out.
That's correct.
All right. So what is the advantage to you to giving away free copies?
Well, I'm trying to reestablish myself in the training business. I gave up the training business after traveling all over the world for years because it was killing me. Training business is very difficult for anybody. And it's especially difficult for diabetics. We're supposed to live a regular life, and you can't do that when you're traveling across time zones. Now there's an immense market for online training, and the book is going to be a foundation of that training. So I don't mind giving it away, getting some action on it, getting some reviews of it.
Okay.
Well, and if it's good, you get word of mouth. You get positive word of mouth.
So that's correct.
Yeah, makes sense to me.
Yeah.
Now on the website, there is a link to videos, and you're giving the first one away for free. And after that, if they like it, they're welcome to
rent some more.
Now, this video is on negotiation. Yep. It looks like it was published a couple decades ago.
Yep.
But on negotiation, I suspect most of the principles haven't changed in the last couple decades.
They haven't changed since people were trading horses in Damascus pre-Christian era.
So how does negotiation relate to poker? How do you integrate those two things?
Well, the critical factor is that both poker and negotiations are information management games. And in all information management games, the trick is to learn as much as you can about the other guy and give away as much or the right kind of information about yourself. That's true what we do in poker. As my friend David Sklansky put it, without deception, the whole game of poker falls apart. If we play with our cards face up, we wouldn't have a game. You couldn't bluff anybody out. You couldn't get a value bet. That's all. So what poker and negotiation are about is managing the flow of information. And that's what I do.
Okay.
So can you give an example of that? How you would apply that in a poker hand?
Oh, sure. The most obvious example of misinformation is the bluff. You bet, and what you're saying is, I can beat you. And if you call me, well, I can't beat you. As a matter of fact, I've got bubkis. I had a flush draw, and I didn't get there. The opposite example is the limping with aces or flopping a set of fours and waiting for the turn to make a move or maybe even waiting for the river, depending on the board. In both cases, you're trying to deceive the other person about the strength of your hand, and you're trying to deceive them about your intentions, your plans.
One of your books is called Business is a Poker Game. What's that all about?
Well, that's why it was my labor of love. I used to be a business professor at Carnegie Mellon University grad school, and I have always been interested in the similarities between poker and business. And it starts with the most basic, most important of all decisions in the game of poker and in the game of business, which is game selection. If you select the right game, you will win. If you select the wrong game, you will lose. Now, that doesn't mean tonight or this week, but it does mean over a long term. For example, I'm an okay player, not a great one, okay. If I play with people who are weaker than me, I will win. If I play with people who are stronger than me, I will lose. And the real problem is that people overwhelmingly misestimate their abilities. They think that they are better than they really are. And we found that in just about anything you can measure, any skill, poker, golf, tennis, lovemaking, dancing, singing, reading, selling, about two-thirds of the people say, I'm above average, which, of course, is a statistical impossibility. And so what I do, I think, quite well is help people to be honest about themselves so that they can pick the right game. And that decision is identical in poker and in business. Let's take an example. There are, in a town like Las Vegas, at least 1,000, probably several thousand, struggling lawyers. They're just not good enough for this game. This is a very, very tough game for lawyers, as you can see, just driving down the road, because you see all the freeway billboards. All right? And what they're trying to do is win in this town, which is a very, very tough market. Exactly the same people, if they move to a small town, could do very, very well. You see this even more dramatically in the medical business. If you're a doc and you want to go to rural Nebraska, they'll give you a house and a car and a magnificent lifestyle because they need docs. They don't need docs in Omaha. We don't need docs in Las Vegas. Same sort of thing is, let's say you're trying to sell something. If I'm trying to sell in a place where there's 14 guys selling pretty much the same product I have, I'm not going to make it. If I'm selling in a place where I'm the only guy in town, I'm going to do very, very well.
So how do you choose the right game in poker?
First and most important, you don't lie to yourself about how good you are or what style you play. If you play at a certain level of skill but the wrong style, you're still in the wrong games in many cases. Let's give an example. A rock, that's an extremely tight player, can win in a full game because he waits and he waits and he waits. A maniac, a guy who's extremely loose aggressive, will lose in that game because he's playing too many hands. And so when he's against the rock has better cards than he does. So he's going to lose. Change things around, make it a four-handed game, and now the rock is at an extreme disadvantage because he can't afford to wait. The blinds will kill him. While the maniac is running over him because the maniac knows how to play inferior cards and the rock doesn't. All right? Well, let's take cash game players versus tournament players. We all know extremely successful, world-famous tournament players who are broke. Right? Am I correct?
Yes. Yes. Oh, yeah. Okay. Absolutely.
I mean, every once in a while we hear that, I'm not going to mention any names because I don't want anybody getting unhappy, but we hear that so-and-so is busted in debt, etc. And he's usually in debt because he played games he couldn't beat. He was terrific at tournaments, but he played cash games. Or he played, worse than that, he played craps. Or he played, right? Or roulette? Or sports betting or whatever. Come on, you guys know this better than I do.
Yeah, no, this is something that always fascinated me because I came from a background of professional blackjack where there is a definite right and wrong play and you know it. It's not like poker where it's subjective. You know the right play and you mathematically can look at exactly the edge. And blackjack players, the professionals, the ones I knew, none of them would dream of going to play craps. I mean, they just wouldn't do it because they know that it's a negative expectation game, and they just wouldn't do it. But poker players seem to have leaks like crazy.
Terrible.
Yeah, and craps, sports betting, whatever it is.
And the reason is they think that the rules apply to you, but they don't apply to me. In fact, the very first article I wrote for Card Player magazine, 18, 17 years ago, was called Arrogance, the Biggest Bankroll Buster. And they did exactly what you're saying, which is they thought, because I'm so good at this poker game, I can beat Pai Gow, or I can beat craps, or I can be a sports bettor because I'm so smart. I almost said a naughty word, folks, but I didn't.
Yeah, when I interviewed Chip Reese for my book, he said that part of it was that the money came so easily that he just felt like, well, even if I lost, I could just make more of it tomorrow.
Just by chance. We were all yesterday at the after party to the blackjack ball. That's where we met. And one of the fellas I drove over there was admitting that one day he got him into an enormous poker game because he was on a hot streak. And he said, well, if I lose, it's like losing house money. No, buddy. Every dollar, once I put it in my pocket, it's mine. You gotta force it out of me. I'm not going
to. It doesn't even have to be in my pocket. Once the chips are in front of me,
right,
it's
they're mine.
Yeah.
And you're going to have to get them out of it. And that's one of the reasons that poker is such a fascinating game for psychologists, because you see people who know better making incredibly stupid moves. The most common of these, or pardon me, the most dramatic of them, is what we call tilt. I had aces. That idiot called me with 7-4 offsuit, and he flopped two pair, and he busted me, and where the hell does he get the nerve to do that to me, and I'm going to get him. No, No, you're not going to get him. If the way you're playing right now, he's going to get you again. Right?
Yeah.
Now, you indicated the most important thing is to choose the right game. And so, like, if you're considering playing me, what you talked about so far was to correctly evaluate your game. But equally important, presumably, is for you to correctly evaluate my game. And to know whether you're better than me or not, you have to know both sides of the equation. Is knowing yourself more important than knowing how good the other one is?
Absolutely.
And why is that?
Because I'm only going to play against you once in a while. I might never play another hand against you. And I got to tell you, I wrote a book called Your Worst Poker Enemy. And Your Worst Poker Enemy begins with a quotation from Stu Unger, who we all know. And Stu said, at the table, your worst enemy is yourself. And what happens is that people make mistakes because every place I go, there I am. And if I'm a jerk here, I'm a jerk there, and I'm a jerk in the other places. And when I wrote Your Worst Poker Enemy, I had a kind of bipolar distribution of reviews. I published on Amazon, and Amazon has these reviews. I got a whole bunch of them. And I got some very, very positive ones. I've had some folks say it's the best poker book they've ever read. And I've had some extremely negative ones. Like, I gave this one star only because I can't give it no stars, you know? It's the worst book I've ever read. I threw it away. And the one I remember the best was a man wrote, he says, amazingly, Schoonmaker opines that we should spend more time studying ourselves and our mistakes than we do studying other people's. And the answer is obviously, of course you should. Because unless you're playing in the same home game every night with the same six or eight people, you're going to be playing against dozens or hundreds, particularly in places like Las Vegas, of players. Which means I may play 1% or 3% of my hands against you and 2% of my hands against you, but I play in my weaknesses affect every single hand I ever play. And so the important person for us to understand is ourselves.
Okay, I'll concede that point. But to know whether you are better than me or better than Richard, you also have to accurately evaluate us.
Oh, absolutely.
Oh, sure. So that's an important skill, right? To sit down in a game and be able to say, you know what? This game is too tough. Mm-hmm. And if you want to tell yourself, you know, well, I could win, but there's no question that the win rate is going to be better over there. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah.
So, it seems to me that's an essential skill for a poker player or as you say, you're just going to go broke.
Well, and it goes further than that. If you play in the large card rooms here in town or in the even larger ones in Los Angeles, you have a tremendous choice of games. And I have friends, when they play in the large rooms, they put themselves down on the list for six games. Because I sit down, it looks to me like this game right here, table seven, is the right one for me. But either I made a mistake, or they're playing differently from what I expected, or two weak players quit and got replaced by two strong players. Well, it's time for me to pick up my chips and go over to table five, where one of those guys moved, and the other, I just looked over, and it seems that I could have a table of relatively soft players. And so you have in poker what we call walkers. Walkers are guys who walk around and walk around and walk around till they find the game they like, and then they play. And sometimes they walk and they walk and they walk, and they say, oh, I'm not going here, so I'm going to the Aria. Well, the Aria didn't have anything. I'm going to the Bellagio. And you can do that in Las Vegas very, very easily. We'll even give you a bus, monorail trail things. So picking the game is what you got to do best.
Well, that's no different than it is in video poker.
No, or blackjack or any game. Shooting pool, yeah.
Oh, yes. The game theory is almost identical whether you're playing business, poker, golf, war, diplomacy, whatever.
Okay, and there I'm going to disagree.
Oh, my God. You can you call broke me, my heart.
You can call me Bob. In video poker compared to live poker, for the most part, the human element is gone in yes. video poker. So now it is, for the most part, evaluating pay schedules, slot clubs, promotions, right. which is much easier than trying to figure out how good of a poker player Richard is or how good of a poker player you are.
Right, but, you know, you still have to know yourself really well because you play for 4 hours and maybe you're not as sharp as you were when you started and maybe you're starting to make errors. And unless Correct. You are self-aware and know that you're not playing 100% and have the ability, because how many guys get stuck and they're like, well, I don't want to leave, you know, even though I don't, maybe I made a mistake, but that'll never happen again, you know, that kind of thinking. So, I mean, those same psychological skills come into play. I think.
What you just talked about is something that I've done a little work on, and my dear friend, the late Barry Tannenbaum, wrote a couple of card player articles about it, which is, it's called prospect theory, and the pain of a loss is approximately double the pleasure of a win of the same amount. And the dumbest words in gambling are, I've got to get even. Because when somebody says, I've got to get even, he's on his way to acting stupidly. I'm serious. I mean, we have all seen people, why'd you play those hands? Well, I've been having all my good hands cracked, so I'm going to play trash, right? That's what they, the guy just beat me with 7-4 offsuit, so what's wrong with playing 8-5? Well, he was lucky, and you're not lucky. So that's the way it goes, babe. You're playing stupidly, and I can tell you, and I assume you guys have had the same thing. I see a friend is clearly on tilt. I tap him on the shoulder and whisper in his ear, "Hey, Joe, go home." No, I can beat these blank, 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 blanks, and they stay. And if you walk into almost any large card room, you're going to see somebody who usually plays a much bigger game, 5-10, no limit, 30-60, hold'em, playing in a much smaller game because he's busted. And you ask him, hey, what happened? And he said, well, and he tells you, I went on tilt and I blew it.
If they're honest, they say yeah. that. Otherwise, yeah. it's somebody got lucky.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
The world conspired against me.
Okay, and you guys, let me tell you, what is the single most common subject for poker players to talk about?
Bad beats.
And you know why people talk about bad beats? Because bad beats justify my lousy results.
Right.
It's not my fault. I had aces. Let me tell you how. And then they'll tell you at great length how they played the hand perfectly. And this idiot who didn't have the sense to fold his stupid cards sucked out on the river or whatever. Okay. It's a justification for my results. And that's what I work on. There are 10,000 people who can tell the folks out there how to play cards better than I can tell them. But what I tell them is why you don't play as well as you know how to play. That's what I do.
Do you consult players in that regard?
Sure.
Another difference in video poker.
Did he see the patient look in his face like, would you guys have stopped babbling? I'll straighten you out.
That's not where I'm coming from. When I teach classes a couple semesters a year, and every semester at least 10 more people come up and they start telling me about their most recent royal flush.
Wow.
And it's like, this is a high point. Now, royal flushes happen in video poker, 40, 45,000 hands, depending on the game. So, not every day, but not all that rare. But these people remember, some don't play very much, but they remember the royal flush. Like, somehow this makes them part of the fraternity because they've had this big win. often I ask them, well, you know, what game were you playing? You know, and they always start out, well, it isn't a game that you'd be caught dead playing. And I'm going, well, then it sounds like it was a mistake for you to be playing too. Well, no, I got a royal flush. It's hard to convince them that...
that playing with a negative expectation is not a good way to go.
Ah, it is. They got a royal flush that day, so that means it was right.
Well, let me go a little further than that. Freakonomics, which is a terrific book, sold 8 zillion copies.
As did the sequel.
And the sequel. Yes. Both of them are wonderful. Pointed out that the great majority of people who become compulsive gamblers had a high the very first time they played. And they've been going, trying to get that high ever since. They're trying to get that feeling, that wonder. Boy, when I saw that King of Spades come up and I had that royal flush, it was better than sex. It was better than alcohol. It was better than cocaine. It was just wonderful. Well, sir, if we add up the money you put in, you ain't doing too well. All right? And that's the thing. That's what differentiates people like yourself, people like me, from the typical player in Las Vegas. We are always out to get an edge. We always want a positive expectation. If I haven't got a positive expectation, I ain't going to play. Right. I haven't got an expectation with these cards and these players at this table, in this seat, at this time. Have a nice day, folks. I'm out of here.
It's interesting. Now I'm 71 years old. It's interesting how my attitude of whether or not a royal flush is better than sex has changed over the years. We are going to take some brief commercials. We're talking to Alan Schoonmaker, and I left a letter out of his name, Schoonmaker, and we'll be back shortly. The South Point has more than 10,000 games, returning more than 99%. This is more than anybody else has. In April, the promotion Monday through Thursday was to earn free buffets. Monday, April 30th is the last day to earn the buffets, and Thursday, May 3rd is the last day to redeem them. Any unredeemed buffets at that time simply expire unused or uneaten, one of the two. Beginning Monday, April 30th through Thursday, May 24th, Monday through Thursday, earn 300 points and earn a spin at the kiosk. The prizes include 2,500 or 5,000 points worth $750 or $15 respectively, a free buffet, $10 food, $25 resort credit, or $15, $25, or $50 in free play. Monday is Senior Day. For those 50 years of age and older, you get half-price meals using points, half-price movies, and a free slot tournament. At videopoker.com, it's the best place to play lots of games. If you sign up for the Gold membership, $8.95 a month or $79.95 a year, this allows you to get correction on most of the games. The game of the week is Magic Deal Poker. This is a 10 coin per line game where periodically, after the deal and before the draw, you receive one, two, or very rarely three Magic Deal cards. These Magic Deal cards convert into the highest paying card after the deal. This is somewhat similar in concept to Dream Card, except in a Dream Card there's at most one, and you pick the best card before the draw, not after. If you don't get a Magic card, your play on this game is exactly the same as in the regular version of the game, only you're paying twice as much as you normally would for that hand. If you do get one or more Magic cards, your play is sometimes intuitively obvious, sometimes not so much. All right. We're talking to Alan Schoonmaker. Who was Herbert Simon?
Herb Simon was the first non-economist to win the Nobel Prize in economics. And I had the privilege of working with Herb. I was junior faculty. He was God. I wasn't his friend because Herb didn't befriend the junior faculty, but I did. We ate lunch. We had two tables set aside for the business school faculty at lunch. And I must have had lunch with him, I don't know, 100 times or more. And I had countless discussions and was on a committee with him. And Herb was one of the founders of what's today called behavioral economics. And behavioral economics challenged the notion that economists had had for centuries that people are unemotional, rational decision makers who unemotionally evaluate all of their alternatives and pick the one with the maximum utility. And Herb said, no, they don't. And he came up with a term called satisfice, which said that people wait until they have a satisfactory alternative and they settle. And he said, the example he gave was, instead of trying to get the sharpest needle in a haystack, they get one that's sharp enough to sew with. And he was relatively, he had relatively newly switched to writing this stuff, and he was, how shall I say, vilified is too weak a word. The economists would have burned him at the stake if they could have, because he was heresy. I mean, everybody knows that people maximize their utility. They know it just as well as they know that the sun revolves around the earth. I mean, everybody knows it. And it was really that kind of thing. If you said you worked in Herb's area, which everybody did because we were multidisciplinary, we were concerned about decision making, you got a lot of crap wherever you went. I'm very serious. And Herb was an amazing man. His PhD was in political science. He won the Nobel Prize in economics. He did great work in psychology. He did wonderful work with computers. Just one of those Renaissance men. One of the smartest guys I've ever met. Maybe the smartest.
Now, was this, isn't that where Danny Kahneman and
O'Kahneman, Tversky. O'Kahneman was followed him. And there's now a whole field of behavioral economics.
Right.
Where what they did was they shifted from how people should think, what we call prescriptive decision making, to descriptive decision making. How do people really think? And this is right down my alley, because if you read every single poker book, it's prescriptive. Here's how you should play. But Al writes about here's how people do play. For example, in Hold'em, people enormously overvalue suited cards. Enormously. And I say, you know how much suited adds to your value? You're going to make a flush about one time out of every 17. That's all.
6%. Yep.
Yep. That's it. Really? Yeah. And you want to know something else? Once in a while, you're going to lose. Somebody's going to have a bigger flush or a full house. And they look like, they look at me like Santa Claus doesn't exist anymore. You just told me the tooth fairy isn't going to give me a dime for my tooth.
But contrary to that, it is 6%, but when you do get it, often those are some of your biggest hands. And you can win big pots with that.
And that's the kick, is that generally speaking, big pots, particularly if you're playing limit poker, pardon me, I shouldn't say this, only if you're playing limit poker, aren't really that important.
Well, in limit, yeah. But no limit, it's a different story.
No limit, in no limit, you can win three hands in a night and have a great night. And you can win 27 hands and end up as a loser. In fact, you can end up busted. I've done it. You've done it. Right? Okay. And that comes back to the point about why are you playing? Are you playing to make money or are you playing for kicks? It's an enormous kick to rake in a big pot. And if you ask people what kind of games they like, they will often say, I like a game with some crazy people in it because the pots are huge. And then I say, well, how do you do in those games? Oh, well, sometimes I win, sometimes I lose. Well, do you have any records? No. Why would I keep records? Because if you don't keep records, you can't decide how well you're making your decisions.
That's the first question I ask anybody who tells me they gamble, especially if they claim to be a professional gambler, is, do you keep records? And yeah, if they don't, I pretty much just discount them immediately. And which was one of my problems. You know, there were, I don't know if you're aware, but there was there were these group of people who claimed that they could control the dice when they throw through them. And they would have these seminars where they would charge people $1,000 to teach them how to throw the dice. And I would always ask, they supposedly had all these amazing results. And I was like, does anybody keep records? You know, did they, and are any of them millionaires now from this? And but yeah, no, they, if they are, they made their millions teaching classes, not in controlling dice.
Well, as a matter of fact, anytime I see the word secrets being advertised to me, I know I'm being lied to. Because if somebody has a really valuable secret, they ain't going to tell me. They're really not. If you really know the winner of tomorrow's football games, you are not going to change the line by telling me about it. If you know how to beat roulette, you're not going to tell me because they're going to change the roulette wheel. Right?
Right.
It's just that simple.
On a related subject, the last class of my next semester is called Secrets of a Video Poker Winner. It is a must-attend class. I recommend that if you have not attended that before, that you make it a high priority.
Yes. Okay. I apologize. Really, you were saying, I withdraw my remarks, Your Honor.
But those aren't really secrets.
I've taught that class a lot, yeah. So I have shared the such secrets as they are. But they are definitely, you're better off knowing them than not knowing them, whatever you call them.
You could call them essential knowledge for video poker players or something.
Something. But I kind of like my title before today anyway. One of, we're talking about Herbert Simon, Kahneman, and Tversky. One of the gentleman I enjoy reading most today, who I believe is in that same field, is Dan Ariely. I would love if he ever addressed poker.
I have had his books recommended to me, and I actually put a hold on one of them, and it hasn't arrived yet, but I can't remember who recommended it very forcefully. Ariely is a highly respected guy by some people I know, but
yes.
I don't know his work, so I can't really comment.
Good. Let me.
He also does a weekly column for the Wall Street Journal. So
okay.
Yeah.
What does the Wall Street Journal know about money?
Right.
And you could actually go on TED Talks. On TED Talks, he has four or five talks, and one actually interesting point is whether somebody was believable had to do with whether or not they had a Carnegie Mellon sweatshirt on. You might enjoy that conversation.
I loved living in Pittsburgh and going to Carnegie Mellon. I was there just before Dorsett came to the University of Pittsburgh. And who's the guy who was the quarterback for the Steelers? God damn, but his name, all right.
Well, Bradshaw was...
Bradshaw, okay.
Okay.
And so I could call you up at 10 o'clock in the morning on Sunday and say you want to go to the Steelers game, and we could go. Now I call you up at 10 o'clock in the morning, we can go a year from now. I went to a number of Steelers games then. Yeah.
Yeah, they did win four Super Bowls in that era and were very...
After I left, they weren't going to do it while I was around.
Okay. We've talked about your worst poker enemy, which would be yourself. You have another book called Poker Winners Are Different. What is that all about?
That and Business is a Poker Game were originally one book. And I sent Kensington, who published Poker Winners Are Different, and I said, here, you can have this in the poker version or you can have it in the business vision. The business version would take a characteristic of a good poker player and then say how it applied in business. And they said, Al, we're not in the business world. We're going for poker. So it's essentially, what are the qualities that make a person successful in poker and in business. And the first of all of these qualities is brutal realism about themselves, their opponents, the game itself. The second is they have a focus on the right subjects. Awful lot of people waste an incredible amount of time on the wrong subjects. They become very adept at listening to what we call the noise, as opposed to understanding what's the critical signal.
Is that a Nate Silver reference?
Pardon?
Is that a Nate Silver reference?
He wrote a book called The Signal.
The Signal and the Noise. Yeah, I know. It was about investment analysis. Yeah.
It's about elections.
Okay. Sorry.
Sorry.
And the next thing is that winners have a very, very high degree of emotional control. You cannot play good poker if you cannot control your emotions. You simply cannot do it. Doyle wrote about this extensively. Doyle wrote a number of books. The one I enjoyed the most was According to Doyle. And he talks about if you're playing angry poker, you're playing stupid poker, so get the hell out. All right? And Doyle begins that book with words I've quoted again and again, saying, don't play your cards, play your people. And I couldn't agree more. I've never met Doyle, but I have immense respect for him as a player and a gentleman, and a writer, of course. The next thing about poker winners are different is that they are judiciously deceptive. Note the word judiciously. If you're too honest, you can't play poker. You really can't. If people can read you, then you can't win. But there are lots and lots of poker players who are judicious for the hell of it. They just want to fool people. And so it's much more fun, we all know, to win a hand with a bluff than it is to win with the best cards. I mean, anybody can win with the best cards. But let me tell you about this great bluff I made. Now, and we've all heard the stories, the war stories about how people made moves. And what they don't tell you is that they got caught. And again, back to the record keeping thing, they are losing money because they're bluffing too often or bluffing in the wrong situation. But the kick of winning through bluffing is enormous. And that brings us back to why the underlying issue is both cognitive and emotional, which is that they're more motivated and more controlled than the typical person. The typical professional poker player, the successful professional poker player, is not there to have fun. He's there to win money. He's out to win money, and he's going to do whatever it takes to win money within the rules. I'm not talking about cheating. I'm talking about he's willing to, for example, bust his own grandmother, as Jack Straus put it. Jack wrote an article years ago where he said, if I was playing poker, I'd bust my own grandmother, right? I wrote an article about that for Card Player and got a lot of flack. Some people said, no, there's only one way to play. No, you shouldn't do this. But basic rule is the real pros are like Jack Straus. Hey, Grandma, I didn't mean to bust you, but I can loan you a couple bucks to get home. All right? So it's the poker. And another thing is that poker winners are willing to pay their dues. They don't expect to win immediately. They don't expect to move from 5-10 to 10-20 to 30-60 in 3 weeks. They play a lot of hands. Barry Tannenbaum, who was a very good friend of mine, said that he made sure that he played 500 or more hours at every single level of successful play. That is, if he didn't win money for the 500 hours, then he didn't move up. Because he said, I want to be sure I can beat this game. Then, because until I can be sure I beat this game, I'm not sure I can beat the next one. And another way you pay dues is every poker player, good poker player I know, spends a very substantial amount of time with other people analyzing his play. We've all got poker buddies, and we sit down and we talk and we say, here's a hand I played last night. I wonder what I did right and wrong. And I have people who like me enough that they tell me, Al, you really screwed that one up. Here's what you should have done.
Yeah, I think that's true in most professions.
That, oh, yes. In fact, if you find a surgeon who doesn't have that kind of relationship with another surgeon, you got a guy who's going to make some mistakes.
Do you have any more poker books in you?
No, I really, really wanted to write a poker book called Irrational Poker. And I just decided it's too much work for the truncated market we've got now. Almost nobody is making any money selling poker books today. I talked to your colleague at the Huntington Press last night, and he's not working in poker anymore. He's going to sports betting. And I've published a bunch of poker books, and the last few, the return was certainly, it worked out to 6 cents a week or something like that, you know? Yeah.
Oh, well, I make 11 cents an hour.
My God. I'm so jealous.
I'm better than you.
Huh? Well, that'll teach me.
I'm better than you there. All right. But you're, now you've been publishing forever at Card Player. Now, I've been publishing about the same length of time on, about video poker. And I find I repeat myself.
Of course we do.
I have written everything I have wanted to write at least three times. Now, how do you avoid that in your writing?
The nice thing about being a psychologist is that every place I go, the subject matter. And there's, of course, a significant element of repetition, but there's enough differences that I haven't really gotten bored yet. It's still fun to write. Right now, I've my last six or seven articles have been about the work of the book of Daniel Kahneman, Thinking Fast and Slow. This is the Nobel Prize winner we were talking about before, because he's done some work that has nothing to do with poker. I think the word poker appears twice in his book, but it's all about how people make decisions. And I have a bunch of friends, a lawyer named Preston Oda, a distinguished psychologist named Arthur Reber, a computer guy named Brad Klein, another computer guy named Nick Christensen. And I write my articles and I send them to them, and then they come back and tell me I'm wrong. Okay? And we spend a lot of time back and forth working it out. And it's intellectually stimulating to have these good friends who are willing to tell me when they think I'm wrong. And right now we're talking about a classic subject in poker, intuition versus math. And I just submitted this morning's article about when can you trust your intuition. I have written a lot about whether intuition or logic is better, but this is a much more narrowly defined subject. When can you, Mr. Reader, Miss Reader, know that it's okay to make an intuitive decision as opposed to a mathematical decision? And I'm going to give you a staggering number. Many years ago, Paul Meehl, an absolutely distinguished psychologist, wrote a book called Clinical versus Statistical Prediction. And it was for students applying to go to college. And you got two groups of data. You got highly mathematical data, SAT scores, grade point average, and the quality of the school. That's numbers. Then you had an essay. When we applied to college, they always asked you to write an essay, right? And then people had a 45-minute interview with a psychologist or an admissions counselor. The mathematical data were given to a clerk, and he made a prediction equation for their grade point average. Pardon me, they compared those scores to the scores of previous groups and what was the weight of them in terms of predicting grades as a freshman at college. They gave all of these data, including the equation, to a psychologist who had, in addition, a four-page essay and a 45-minute interviewer. Which one predicted grades better?
The interviewer.
Nope.
Really?
The mathematical equation done by a clerk, somebody who just took things up off a form, some entry-level person, beat the expert. When they published these results, the psychologists were furious.
I'm sure.
How can you say this? A clerk can beat me? Do you realize how many years I've been studying psychology? It gets better. Over the next 50 years, similar studies were done for grades, for the probability of a business to succeed, for the probability of sick people to recover, for the probability that a criminal would go back to jail, for various forms of medical diagnosis. There are approximately 200 studies, and in not one of them did the experts beat the clerks. Not one. They either broke even or the clerk won. It's even on, believe it or not, the quality of vintages for wines.
That's why my mantra to my kids was math is where the money is.
Well, you know, I wrote a book with Davis Glansky, and it's called DUCY, and we start with exactly that point, which is we have a little anecdote. Whatever happened to Johnny the Nerd? And he said, oh, he's making zillions of bucks, all right? Because if you know how to do math logic, you know how to think properly. That's what we have a chapter called Math is Just Good Thinking. That's what it is. And by chance, my second wife was in a medical residency program. She had diagnostic problems. And I said, look, honey, go back to when you were in high school and they talked about, you know, you have a train leaving here and a train leaving there. She said, I did that in high school. I said, yeah, but you didn't learn the logic of it. The way it's the same logic, which is setting up the problem properly. Once you understand how the problem should be set up, the rest is easy. It's multiplication and division. All right? So the same logic applies again and again and again. So why do the clerks win?
No judgment, just numbers.
Joe, no. Okay. But shouldn't I, Alan the Great, psychologist, etc., professor of this, professor of that, all those guys, we're quite qualified people. Why couldn't they add something to the numbers?
Ego?
Mm-hmm. Because what happened was they would make assumptions that were not consistent with the data. For example, I interview somebody and he's got a bad attitude. Or I think that he had good extracurricular activities. Or he worked nights or whatever. But these things aren't experientially related to success. And that's what they found is the cause for the literally, Paul Meehl said it, the most consistent finding in all of the social sciences is there's never been a case that the clerks lost. Not one. And I got to tell you, my friends were outraged when I said them this. They said, you don't understand intuition, that. No, sir, that's what the facts are. That's what the numbers say.
Oh, so he's one of those guys who believes in science.
Oh, gosh, yes.
I'm wondering, is the conclusion that our listeners should buy clerk's books rather than doctor's books? Is that the conclusion of all this?
No, it's that don't go away from the math unless you have very, very good reasons to believe that the math is not sufficient. And the next is, don't believe you have intuition unless you have solid evidence that you can. Ask people to describe their own intuition, and I guarantee you what they'll do is they'll tell you the time they made a great play. That guy shoved in, and I just knew he was bluffing, and I called him down, and goddamn, I was right. And how many times were you wrong? Oh, I don't know. Okay? And again, it comes back to records. It comes back to math. It comes back to data. And I'm a data-oriented guy. You cannot graduate from a place like Berkeley without being data-oriented. If you said where I was, oh, I just felt that, they would have said, Alan, it was nice having you. Have a nice day. Get out of here. They would throw me out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Very good. We've been talking to Professor Alan Schoonmaker, psychologist, writing about poker. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you.
It was very educational. Thank you, Richard. Go out and hit lots of royal flushes, everybody. Good day.